Hey everyone, I'm your host Michael Nova, and welcome to Rise Up Radio. Jai Utal is known as a pioneer in the world music community. His new album, Roots Rock Rama, named after Bob Marley's classic track Roots Rock Reggae, has been described as his life's spiritual and musical quest, packed into two CDs of 78 minutes of music. Parts of the proceeds of the album will be donated to One Tree Planted, which is an organization that plants trees in order to combat world deforestation. Jai's first album, Footprints, featuring jazz artist Don Cherry and others, was released in 1990. But since then, he's released 18 albums and received a Grammy Award nomination. But Jai is more than a music artist. He also leads his own yoga workshops and retreats and has an inspirational story of overcoming adversity that is not as widely known as his music. Here's our interview with Jai. Jai, let's start with your music history and how you originally started singing professionally. Regarding singing in front of people, in your bio it says, "I was terrified at first, but somewhere along the line, I realized that I couldn't be paralyzed by fear because singing was my salvation and spiritual catharsis." Can you please share with us how you overcame that fear of performing in front of people?
Well, I can't say that I've overcome that fear. I can say with a pretty full heart and full mind that I'm no longer paralyzed by that fear. My journey as a musician, for many years, I considered myself just an instrumentalist. You know, I played the Indian instrument sarod, and before that banjo and guitar, and studied very much. And, you know, I saw and felt myself as a musician from quite a young age and as a spiritual musician. But I started singing, when I was studying Indian classical music with Ali Akbar Khan, who's greatest, one of the greatest masters, music masters who's ever lived. He insisted that all of his students study vocal music as well. My focus at the time was the sarod, which is a 25-stringed Indian classical amazing instrument. So Kansab said, "Well, he won't teach us if we don't study singing as well." And most of the students, not the Indian students, but most of the students here, the Western students here in California, were very resistant. But we did it because our teacher was telling us we had to do it. So I remember, you know, practicing the raga scales vocally and the songs that he was teaching. And I had to make sure that I was completely alone in my house. I was in a shared household, and I even looked out the window. Would look out the window and make sure the neighbor's car wasn't there before I would practice singing. But I began to have this very, like, you know, a beautiful feeling while I was practicing the compositions and the ragas and the scales. Just a connection, an internal connection that I hadn't felt before. And, you know, it kind of surprised me and it kind of scared me because I was just 19 at that point, and I saw, you know, indications of the path to come, and I didn't want to go on it because there is a way, I feel, in which singing more than anything else exposes you and exposes your vulnerability, at least for myself, you know, exposes the me that I don't want other people to see. Anyway, time passed and I went to India. Still, you know, I was playing instruments and jamming, but I was not a singer. But I became more and more involved with group kirtan singing, chanting, where, you know, your voice kind of melts into the whole. It's an amazing, amazing thing where the individual voice what's the word? It's just like embraced by the voice of everybody together, the voices of everybody together. And I started to get more and more into that. And then that practice became more and more connected with my relationship to my guru, Neem Karoli Baba. So, you know, but this was all very private, right? Or with a group of very close friends. And it was nothing to do with my career. It was nothing to do with my sense of myself as a musician. This was my sadhana, my personal practice to connect with God. So anyway, like I got back from India, and time passed, and people started asking me to come and share these chants in different groups, and you know, to lead them and talk about them, you know, talking in front of people. My God, that was like even worse than singing. Now sometimes you just can't get me to shut up. It's the opposite. But anyway, so I would say yes to these invitations, but I was so, you know, completely freaked out, nervous about it. And I'm talking about a period of quite a few years. This wasn't like an overnight thing or a year thing. This is probably over two decades, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I started writing songs, but thinking of them but more as demos, you know, for other artists. But then I very slowly started incorporating all my studies of Indian music and both classical and Indian, you know, folk music, devotional music, and combining them with my Western musical understanding and education and abilities, you know. So I made my first album. It was called Footprints. And on that album, I sang only one song. Most of the album was instrumental. But I sang for one song. And then I played it for Ali Akbar Khan. And he was very pleased with me. He said that he thought it was very, in his words, you know, it's very in tune. Hmm. But anyway, my life became, you know, it's so funny because many people, they find the spiritual path after they've been through a lot of the suffering in their lives.
Right.
That's sort of the norm, if there is such a thing as the norm. Me, I really discovered my spiritual path as a teenager and you know, it was so clear and it was so firm and strong. And then I met my guru when I was 19, not even planning to meet a guru, not going, you know, well, that's a whole other story, but it was quite by accident. Mm-hmm. I laugh because it's obviously not an accident. You know, I mean, I was 19 years old. I went to India. None of it's an accident, but nothing went according to what I thought my plans were. But anyway, I met Neem Karoli Baba and you know, it was so clear. And yet then after that, I guess it was, you know, all my samskaras, you know, that's a Sanskrit word that means, I guess you could say, leftovers from previous lives, imprints, and all my childhood traumas and all this stuff began to bubble up in me. And for, you know, years, while I was doing my spiritual practice, while I was doing my music, while I was sharing this with other people, I was deeply conflicted inside and completely drug addict, alcoholic. I guess you could say I was functioning, but then it becomes questionable what functioning means, you know, functioning on the outside, but collapsing on the inside.
Why did you originally become addicted to drugs?
That's a question that is asked by people who suffer from that disease, like 1,000 times. Why did this happen to me? How did this happen? And you know, it's not an easy question to answer, because two people can have the same early childhood experiences and life experiences, and one person will become an addict and another person won't. So I'll just, you know, answer in a nutshell. Well, I had my first alcoholic blackout when I was about seven. It was at a Passover service, and I really liked getting drunk. But let's just say, to put it very simply, I think it had to do with this dread fear that fear of life that I felt as a child, as a little child, as a baby, and as a child, and into manhood. And I think it has to do with DNA. You know, both of my parents were alcoholics, and I think it also a little bit has to do with the times in which I was growing up. You know, the drugs and, well, I didn't drink as a hippie, but you know, certainly drugs were very, very, very big part of that whole time. Mm-hmm. And at first it seemed very positive. You know, these were the psychedelics that were opening up the doors. Anyway, but basically I couldn't find my place in life. I felt extremely alienated, and this was from very young. And you know, I'm not going to go into my, you know, my personal family history, but it wasn't an easy one. Mm-hmm. But many people experience difficult childhood, so I'm not even considering myself unique or special. But I was really afraid. You know, I didn't know how to take the next step each day. Mm-hmm. I woke up in fear, and I spent the day in fear. And this was even, you know, the imprints were so deep that this was even after, as I said, you know, entering onto the spiritual path. So, you know, so somewhere over the course of those years, well, I was started putting out more albums, and I put my band together at the time called the Pagan Love Orchestra. And most of it at first was instrumental music, and then gradually I was bringing my chanting and my kirtan singing, my mantra singing into this. A Pagan Love Orchestra was this fusion of you know, rock, reggae, and jazz with Indian music. And at the time, it was completely unheard of. Now, you know, all these kind of world music blends are a little bit more common. And developing some like amazing stuff is coming out now, particularly from India. But at the time, it was really, really, really new for the world. And so, you know, our only venues to perform were of course, nightclubs and bars and stuff. But like more and more singing was being called forth. And as my singing started coming out with it was coming, you know, this such fear, you know, it was like, oh my God, I can't do this. I remember one time sitting on the side of the stage right before we were supposed to go out. And I turned to my buddy, I think it was the bass player in my band. And I said, you know, I can't do this. I cannot go out there and sing. Hmm. And of course he grabbed me and said, we're going out there. But you know, as a result, I was drinking very heavily and taking a lot of drugs. But somewhere along the line, internally, I began to feel that for my soul and my spirit, what I needed more than anything, more than playing instruments, you know, and I love playing instruments. I love strings, particularly. I love what they do to me as I just strum them. But I began to feel that the inner need was to sing, and with that conviction was, you know, this huge well of terror, which was like, no, Jai, you can't do that. You're not a singer. You don't have a good voice, and you don't want everybody to see your insides of your soul anyways. So, like, you know, you're doing – that's wrong, man. So I had these two, you know, warring sides in me, right?
Mm.
And then – but after some time, I just had to say, well, look, if I don't sing, something inside of my spirit is going to die. And I made a choice. You know, it was a choice. I had to sing. Now, I wasn't sober, so I used everything I could to help me cross that abyss and sing. And, you know, maybe at first the substances were an ally, but anyone who's been through the path of addiction or the, not a path, you know, like whatever, the road of addiction knows that very quickly a substance turns from an ally to the enemy. And, well, that's what happened. And you know, but it went on for years and years. And it's funny, you know, it was the one part of my life that was a complete secret. My close friends, of course, and the people in my band, you know, they knew where I was at. But to the world, it wasn't that my spiritual, you know, chanting and music, it wasn't hypocritical, because that part was completely sincere and always was, and I pray always will be. But the fact that I had to, you know, basically get totally loaded before doing it in front of people, yeah, that part was secret. And, well, anyway, time passed and, you know, just integrity crumbled, my body crumbled, everything crumbled, my marriage crumbled. And my best friend said, Jai, let's get you into a treatment facility. And he was sober for a whole bunch of years. And I said, why? You know, I'm doing okay. And he said, no, you know, from the outside looking in, the world thinks you're doing okay, but I know you and you're suffering too much. So there was no judgment, you know, it was only love. Because a couple of people had really judged me and said, man, you're the worst, you better get sober. And when people judge you, it's hard to respond. It's hard to go along with what they say when it comes with so much judgment. Even inside, you know it's true. But anyway, this one good friend, we talked, and I went into a treatment. And you know, he said, call me every day, and I did. He's still a very, very close friend. This was 16-ish years ago. So I'm in this place, and after, you know, after say maybe 10 days or something, I started to feel just like a little bit more human again. But I knew, I said, okay, I think I like this sobriety thing. I think I can begin to try to accept how God wants to express himself day by day through my life, without feeling like I have to alter it. But I know that one thing is clear. I will never perform again. So I have to figure out a new, you know, a new way to make a living, a new way to just find myself in the world. And that was a big mystery. But I was convinced that I would never perform again, because I knew that there was so much stress in the performance that it would just, you know, make me move to substances again. So pretty shortly, like toward the end of my stay in the treatment center, one of the counselors brought in for us a DVD, or I guess at that time it was a VHS, of Robin Williams performing at Carnegie Hall. And it was right after he had come out of treatment for his cocaine addiction. Mm-hmm. Now, Robin Williams is he's a hero, and it, you know, his death, his suicide is so devastating, but to me, he's still a hero. And so we're watching this, and he's of course really funny, and, you know, I just love him. He's so great. But then about 10 minutes or so into his performance, he went to the very edge of the stage and he crouched down almost into like a fetal position, and he said, I am so terrified. This is the first time I've ever done this sober. And then he ran off behind one of the props on the stage and just hid for a few minutes. And to this day, I don't know if that was scripted or if it was like completely spontaneous. But, you know, it doesn't matter, because it changed my life. And I realized that if I can be honest with people and, you know, let them know, let everyone know what I'm going through, in, you know, be vulnerable, then I could move forward and I could sing in front of people and I could play music in front of people and I could share my being in front of people. Because I realized that people love you more when they see your vulnerabilities. And I guess that changed my life.
That's a really powerful realization for you to come to. So were you then able to get past this fear?
I realized, okay, well, this has been with me my whole life. It may be with me the rest of my life. So I might as well come to some some kind of a peace with it, and some kind of a, if not a friendship, some kind of a civil agreement. and you know, like, okay, I see that fear. You know, my, of course I see it. My hand's shaking. Let's move forward anyway, because I know what my soul needs, and I know what is very clear to me, what my job on earth, this life is, aside from being a father, because that's my main job. But secondary to that is to share my songs and my singing and my music. And through that, the ancient tradition of chanting of mantras with people. And so, you know, I still... very often, this trips me out, you know. My life right now, well, you know, I've never made really any money with my music. Mm-hmm. So financially, we're always like teeter-tottering. And my wife is a yoga teacher, so, you know, of course she doesn't make gobs of money. But we live a beautiful life. And our family, you know, my wife, myself, and my 11-year-old son, we're our love for each other and our spirit is so full of grace and so beautiful. And, you know, we make enough money that we rent a house in a nice area. It's a rental, you know, and we eat mostly organic food and pretty much don't do anything, you know, outside of the house.
Yeah, that sounds familiar, yeah.
Yeah, but my son goes to a good school, and so, you know, these are the important things. I have my instruments are good and they're well maintained, and but anyway, what I started to say was that I still very often wake up in the morning in fear. You know, I don't know what happens to my psyche when I'm asleep, but I still have very frequent nightmares and. You know, so those imprints from wherever they came are still there. But I wake up, and the first thing I do is I say, you know, a couple of minutes of prayers. It's just like nothing. I'm still in bed, you know, and I just like say a couple of prayers. And then I get up, and then I open my eyes to the evidence that grace surrounds me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess, you know, like previously I would wake up in fear and immediately try to squash the fear. And now I will wake up in fear. Again, not every day. I don't want to over make it sound like I'm insane, but I wake up with that feeling and then I pray and I accept and I, you know, as much as possible go through my day with an open heart and, you know, a focus and a clear mind as much as I can. Mm-hmm. So I remember last time we talked, your first question was, how did I overcome adversity? And I think my response was something like, well, overcoming adversity to me is a daily, you know, like we say in 12-step programs, one day at a time. Well, just in terms of life, it's one day at a time.
Yeah.
I try to keep, you know, one portion of my vision on the big picture, but really it's, you know, a day for me, it's filled with joy and it's also filled with challenges. And how do I react to the challenges and how do I share the joy? Those are the, you know, every day, like adversity. You know, last night I had very bad asthma. I have had asthma since I was six. Most of the time it's pretty okay, but it comes in flares, right? And so that's adversity. You know, it's like makes me so nervous inside and uncomfortable. And I didn't overcome it, but I did my evening prayers and offerings that I do every night before bed. And I had such a sweet, loving exchange with my wife and son. It was Valentine's Day. You know, we all gave each other little cards and gifts. And I just saw, okay, I'm struggling. I'm suffering with this now, but it's only a part of my reality.
Yeah.
And you know, today it's eased up. It's still there, you know, but it's eased up. And so adversity comes and you know, the challenges come every day, different kinds of challenges, you know, all kinds of different things. And so I feel that overcoming adversity is our daily, you know, it's part of our incarnation, and it's a day to day, one day at a time thing. It's like when, you know, people in recovery from addictions, they never say, well, the smart ones mm-hmm. never say, I've recovered. I used to be an alcoholic. I've recovered. Mm-hmm. Or used to be a heroin addict. I've recovered. More often than not, they say, my life is a process of recovery. And every day I reinvest my spirit into that recovery. And so I see that with addiction, but not only with addiction, just, well, you can say the addiction we all have to negative thoughts, to negative reactions, to choices that we make that lead to suffering rather than choices that we make that lead to the alleviation of suffering. You know, it happens. We make 1,000 choices every day. And, you know, sometimes we think, well, I'm not, you know, there is the side that says, well, this is all predetermined and I'm not really, I only think I'm making choices. And, you know, that may or may not be true, and I sort of think it is true, but still we have to act as if.
Yeah. So it sounds like, to me, it sounds like for you, it's where you put your focus. It's like the fear can be there, but if you just focus on something else for a moment and don't focus in on the fear, that's how you overcome it? Is that true?
Kind of, but it's not like taking the fear and trying to put it in a box or put mm-hmm. stuff it in the closet or put mm-hmm. it under the rug. It's more like, yeah, okay, I know you. I know mm-hmm. what you got to say. Have a nice day. I'm doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah.
Do it anyway.
Do it anyway.
Just do it, right?
You know, we do these kirtan camps. My wife and I, where it's a yoga and kirtan. Kirtan is mantra chanting, and we do these camps, and we have, you know, it's great fun. It's beautiful. They're beautiful camps. And one of the things that we sometimes do is we'll pass a little potato shaker, you know, like a musical shaker in the shape of a potato, and we'll play hot potato. And whenever someone is holding the potato for 1 minute, they have to lead the group in a chant. Hmm. And, you know, everybody is like completely scared, right? Hmm. And I just say, yeah, we're scared. Fear is also another, it's also a God-given emotion. All of the emotions that live in the human being are part of the full rainbow spectrum of human life. So let's not run away from the fear. Let's just like have fun with fear. And I know it's kind of an odd thing to say, but in a group where everyone feels safe and loving with each other and that, you know, there's a lot of humor always, we can just sort of experiment with that concept of fun with fear. Not that fear is really fun, but if we look at it and have a sort of a bit of a humor that, wow, look at you. look at you, Mr. Fear. You're really trying to dominate me, but I'm going to sing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, everyone has very, very deep experiences. And one thing we discover is that as we go around the circle, each person is so, like, as they listen and respond to all the other people, every single one of us seems so beautiful and so poignant and so vulnerable and so human. And then when it comes to ourselves, we're so harsh, you know, and that's a pretty common realization that everybody loves everyone else's 1 minute, but can't stand their own. And then, you know, when you see that 30 people in a room have that same exact experience as you, it lessens the hold of self-criticism, you know, and,
yeah.
And, it's a really great thing to do. And it is fun, even though it's scary.
Hmm.
I mean, I guess some people like to go on roller coasters and have fun with fear.
Yeah.
But I'm too scared about roller coasters. I don't go on them. Which is it's one of the ways I'm disappointing my son. There's some things that I just can't do with you, my love.
Oh, that's too bad.
Luckily, my wife is, you know, she's okay with roller coasters.
That's good. That's good. So going back to the music, how did you originally hook up with Ali Akbar Khan? And what got you into Indian music in the first place?
You know, I mentioned the word before, samskaras. Are you familiar with that word at all?
What is it?
Samskaras.
Samskars?
No, it's one word. It's S-A-M-S-K-A-R-A-S, samskaras.
No, never heard of it.
It's a Sanskrit word, and it means, basically it means imprints from previous lives.
Hmm.
And, you know, of course, you know, some people don't think about that stuff, and it's meaningless. But for some reason, when I was, you know, it started when I was like, you know, really young, like 10 or 11, anything that was from I won't say all of Asia, but like from India, Middle East, Pakistan, you know, anything from that side of the world just piqued my interest big time. And I would see like pictures of, you know, people in the mountains in India and photos or, you know, like in travel stores or just anywhere, National Geographic, you know, and every time I would see one of these pictures, I would get this like tingles and shivers. Like, wow, I want to be that person.
Mm.
It wasn't like I want to go there. It was like I want to be him.
Mm.
And then, you know, it was the '60s, and India was in the air as also, and I was just I had this huge attraction, and then I started to begin to hear Indian music. And this was while I was in high school. You know, I was really into the Beatles and, of course, their whole India experience. And I was really into Jimi Hendrix. And I was, you know, playing electric guitar and trying to find all the sounds that I could find. That's not that that's Indian, but, you know, really exploring. And then I came across some Indian music albums, both classical music by Ali Akbar Khan and some albums by Ravi Shankar, the sitar player, and also some like rural street music, village music of India from the bowels of Bengal. The bowels of Bengal are a sect in West Bengal that sing very unique and ecstatic devotional songs. So there was a record there was a couple of records by them. We were talking vinyl, you know, on Nonesuch. And then they came there. Do you know Bob Dylan album, John Wesley Harding?
Mm-hmm.
The cover has Bob and a farmer guy and two Indian guys.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you recall, but they were two members of this troupe of musicians from the bowels of Bengal. They came to Woodstock. Allen Ginsberg brought them there. So anyway, there was all these things, and every time any one of them came into my awareness, like an album or something, I was just transfixed. Why? Who knows? Huh. Anyway, so I went to Reed College in Oregon in 1969. And, you know, I was just wanted to get away from New York as far as I could. And so I went there. And on the eve of classes, you know, my freshman year, I hadn't even taken a class yet. On the eve before the classes started, Ali Akbar Khan gave a concert there. And, you know, I don't know. Basically, the concert completely entered me, broke apart my molecules, and reassembled them. And I knew that I had to study with this man. So I got through my first semester at college, and I failed music, and I failed religion, and I dropped out. And I went down from Portland to stay with a friend in Berkeley, California. And Ali Akbar Khan had his school at that time in San Rafael, and I went over there thinking that, you know, I could never actually be part of the school because I don't know anything, and thinking I would have to audition or something. But I found out that he accepted everyone as a student.
Wow.
And, you know, my parents were not happy with me for dropping out of college, so they wouldn't support me. But they gave me a little money for just the first semester. And, you know, once I was there, I was so – it was so great. And the music that I was learning was so great, and it was just so deeply connected, you know, to my insides. And I loved and love Ali Akbar Khan so much. You know, he died 5 years ago, but I was close with him from 1969. I would say I was one of his probably worst students because, well, for whatever reason, I don't even know. But you know, I was also one of his only students that was taking what he was teaching and taking it very seriously and bringing it into other genres and other realms. There was a couple of people, but not many. And he really then I just felt that it was time to stop. Not necessarily stop for good, because I didn't stop for good. I went back, but I took a break. I needed to take a break. I wanted to play rock and roll. And, you know, punk music was really getting popular. And it's not that I liked punk rock exactly. It was, you know, I needed more refinement, but I liked the energy and I was, you know, I had to be part of it. So, so anyway, then I started writing songs, kind of very, you know, you could say pop songs, but they were not. They were pretty abnormal, but I was trying to, you know, get a foot into that. And I did that for a while. And, you know, I even got a demo contract at one point from A&M Records, where they gave me money to make demos and go into a really good studio. And, but after a while, I just, you know, it wasn't really happening. Nothing was really happening. It was just too competitive, that world. Pop music, I mean, God, forget it. Mm-hmm. But and this was, I guess, the I don't know, 80s? No, late 70s. I can't remember. Anyway, you know, and then I went back to study Indian music again. And around the same time, I started to get into technology and finding, you know, I got a sampler, one of the first samplers. Uh-huh. And I was just completely obsessed with what it could do. And I wasn't really into computers, but I got a dedicated sequence. So I started composing music that was taking my, you know, what I had experienced from Indian classical music, as well as what I had experienced from Indian village music and the music from Bengal, and as well as what I had experienced in the temples in India, which is a whole nother music. And putting them together with a sampler, and I was really, I never thought that, this was just like a private passion, you know what I mean? I said, nobody in the world is going to be interested in this, but I am, and I'm having a good time. So then I played it for some friends who had started a record company, and their record company was really a jazz company, but they were curious what I was doing, and they wanted to put it out. So I went to the studio. We remixed everything in a more proper way, and my first album was called Footprints. And also, I had two guests on Footprints that were great musicians and really brought some attention to the album. One was Don Cherry, trumpet player, who I don't know if you know of him, but he was a very big name in the free jazz world, and he had gone to India and studied Indian music, and so we had a lot of commonality, even though I'm not a jazz musician and never really was, but we became really good friends, and he was very well known in certain circles. And then I invited an Indian singer named Lakshmi Shankar, who was the niece of Ravi Shankar, and she's a classical singer, and she was also very, very well known. And she came and sang a song, and Don Cherry played trumpet on a bunch of songs. So my first album, it had a little something that drew people's attention. And it became, I'll say it took off, but we're speaking relatively because this is completely out of the mainstream. But it got a lot of attention, and it got amazing reviews, and it sold CDs, and I was so amazed, because I thought, well, when I had it as in my hand as a finished CD, I was like, wow, that's cool. But I never thought that anyone would listen to it, and it became really popular. But then Michael, the scary thing was that the next step was to put a band together and perform the music. So then we get into some of the stuff that I was talking about before. But that's how it happened. And then I did another. And then I produced two albums for my teacher, for Ali Akbar Khan, using, that sampler technology and everything. And those were great experiences. Hard, because he was a tough, he's a tough guy. Very loving, but not a softie. That's for sure. And really a perfectionist. So they were difficult experiences, but just great. Just great. It solidified my deep friendship connection with that master, and anyway, they were great. And then so it was just one. That's how it started.
So how did you end up receiving a Grammy Award nomination?
Well, that surprised me more than anyone. I guess it was, it was Mondorama. So it was, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. It was my fifth album, I think. I had gone through, after my fourth album, which was Shiva Station, I had had a big falling out with the record company, and I was deeply into my addiction and my alcoholism, and, I was bitterly resentful of the record company and things that they did. And, in retrospect, I see they were not honest with me, and there was a lot of sleazy stuff happening. But I also see that my own desire and ego, fueled by addiction, equally co-created that falling out. But anyway, so I was really depressed, and but then I got a record deal for this fifth album called Mondorama, and actually it was over the course of that album that my marriage dissolved. I went into treatment for all these addictions. I came out sober. I was scared to be sober. I you know, reconnected with the woman who is now my wife and my soulmate. And, you know, it was like really a time of huge transformation for me. And I was, I guess, 49, you know, I was 50. I turned 50 before we completed that album. So I was 50 when that album came out. And, you know, for the first time, really, in 35 years, I was sober. Anyway, big changes. And then I put out the album. The record company didn't like it because, they just didn't like it. Mm. They were expecting something much more new agey and much more palatable, I guess. I don't know what the word is. I don't know why they expected that, because Mondorama is a definitely a, you know, musically you can almost hear it as a logical next step from the album before it, Shiva Station. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reasons, it wasn't popular with the company, so they dropped me very quickly, within 3 or 4 weeks after the release of the album. And almost the same day that they dropped me, I got a Grammy nomination.
Huh. For the same album.
Same album, yeah. And at first I was like, oh, forget it. Who cares? Grammys, I don't care about that stuff. But then I realized that was sort of a, you know, defense mechanism, right? I didn't care about it because I was so sure I wouldn't win it, and I didn't want to have hurt feelings around it, so I pretended I didn't care. Mm. But that fell away pretty fast, and I realized, well, this is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, even if I don't win it, just the fact that my music has, you know, there's this level of appreciation in the mainstream big old world, to an affirmation towards what I'm doing. And
What category would they put you in? World music?
Well, I wished it was world music, but it was a new age category.
Huh.
And I don't know if you know that album, Mondorama. It is so, you know, it's very rocking. It's not new age at all. But I guess, you know, the spiritually oriented music was just shifted to that category. And nowadays, you know, there's been several mantra CDs, devotional CDs that have received Grammy nominations, and it's all been in the new age category. So I'm fine with that, but that was what it was. And then my wife and I, we were all excited. We were going to the Grammys. It was going to be in New York, and we were here in California, and we got clothing and, you know, all kinds of, like, we were all psyched, right? It was before my son was born. And then I got pneumonia the week before. You know, I've had, as I think I mentioned, I had asthma since I was a kid, so my lungs are vulnerable, you know, which is all also a bizarre dichotomy to be a singer with, you know, such compromised, compromised, not the right word, but with vulnerable breathing. So I got really sick. So we didn't go, and I didn't win the Grammy. And yeah, of course I was disappointed, but I wasn't destroyed. That's for sure. It was so cool just to get the nomination.
So you put out 18 albums?
Yeah, I think that's the count.
Okay.
Or maybe 19 if you include a couple of compilations. Compilations of my own music.
Mm-hmm. So your new album, Roots Rock Rama, has been financed by two friends of yours and by fans donating through Patreon.com.
Yes.
But before we go into this, can you describe what Patreon.com is? It's a website that does what?
Yeah, it's a web platform, really, that is bringing back or attempting to bring back the ancient system of patronage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the past, and not even in the far distant past, you know, artists and scientists and writers and playwrights, Shakespeare, you know, everyone was supported in their work through patronage, whether it was from a very rich benefactor or just, you know, a couple of people lending their hands. Even in the spiritual realm in India, it's still expected that if a sadhu, a spiritual seeker, comes to your door and asks for food, it's expected that it's a good karma. It's a good thing to help others in that way.
Yeah.
And you know, my teacher Ali Akbar Khan spent years under the patronage of a king in Rajasthan, and he said that, you know, he would never have developed in the way that he did develop as a musician without that patronage. And every great artist in every field that we see in history, you know, like from Renaissance times, always had benefactors and patrons. So Patreon, well, it's a play on the word patron. And they are introducing a way that fans can become the patrons of the artists that they love. And it's actually very simple. It's a system where fans pledge a certain amount each month to just help the artists continue their work. And you know, every artist on Patreon has, you know, a unique, slightly different way that they approach it. Myself, I post videos on Patreon, but they're all home movies, not fancy production. But like, you know, of me singing, of me talking, of me, you know, in the middle of writing a song in progress, just kind of to bring people into my creative and spiritual life. And you know, I do a minimum of one a week, and some weeks I do a whole bunch. Occasionally, I do a little tutorials on either the guitar or the harmonium. And, you know, I urge people, or I ask people, I say, you know, pledge $1 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really fun. I think that the people who are following me on Patreon really, really enjoy it, because it's the stuff I post is just unique for that platform. And you figure, like, if you I pledge to a bunch of people on Patreon, you figure $1 a month, that's $12 a year, which is nothing. And yet, if a lot of people pledged $1 a year to an artist that they appreciate and admire and love, it would make a difference to that artist. So, you know, that's what it is. And for musicians, you know, on Patreon, there's everybody. There's cartoonists. There's like everybody who is trying to live a creative life in 2017, where it's safe to say arts are not valued quite as much as they used to be.
Yeah. So how did all this lead to you funding the album?
Well, actually, you know, I thought, as I said, I was doing all that work on my iPad. You know, I figured, like, forget it. I'm not going to put another album out. No one cares about music anymore. And, you know, so I was sort of in a depressed state. And then I lost all of my iPad files. And I was sitting on here at home on the very same couch that I'm sitting on right now as I talk to you. And I realized I have to get in the studio now, or else this kind of depression was going to really take hold of me and I'll just give up on music. So I called my friend Ben, who I've done pretty much all my albums with, and he lives very close to me. I said, Ben, can we schedule a time? I don't have any money. I don't know what I'm doing. I promise you, I know that I'll be able to pay you back somehow, but let's start booking some time. So we did, and you know, something inside of me just like lit up again and surged, and it was all flowing really well. And then I was a little stumped. Like, I don't want to do a Kickstarter campaign. Not that I think there's anything wrong with it. I think it's amazing. I think it's great. And but I just, my energy, you know, intuitive energy just wasn't there. I couldn't. Kickstarter's a lot of work, and it's fine to do that work if you feel enthused about it, but I couldn't feel enthusiastic about it. I couldn't do it. So I was just moving forward, not really knowing what to do. And then one day, this was like crazy. I'm just hanging out with some friends, and they asked me, and it so happens that one of these people is my student, and the man in the couple is one of the founders / funders of Patreon. And, you know, so we're just chatting, and I said, how much does it, would it cost you to make an album? And I told them, you know, sort of a mid-range thing, and they said, wow, yeah, that's a lot. And that was it. Then the conversation moved on, right? It was no thinking. I was not thinking about anything about it. And then a week later, I got a check in the mail from them. And I called them. I said, what are you doing? And they said, you know, your music has been part of our life for 25, 30 years. We want to support you in this project. And I said, well, thank you, but, you know, it's a bad investment because you know, CDs now are, if they make their money back, it's a miracle.
That's right.
And they said, well, Jai, this is not an investment. This is a gift.
Wow.
And I was like, no, I can't receive that. That's, you know, I feel like, well,
take the money.
Yeah, so that's what it was. And it felt really like a blessing.
Uh-huh.
And then Patreon, you know, the money, the financial support I received through Patreon is certainly, it's not enough to make an album, but it still comes regularly, and it's enough to add a little bit of a boost. And, you know, it hasn't blossomed into a huge thing, but I think that Patreon is a very slowly growing venture, because it takes people a little while to kind of understand what it is. But anyway, my benefactors on Patreon, every dollar that they've pledged has gone into that project as well,
mm-hmm.
because the original figure that these two people, that I had told these two people, was, you know, I underestimated. But the beauty is that I was able to pay the people who worked with me on this album nicely.
Yeah.
You know, I never feel like I'm able to pay the musicians and the artists that I work with what they really deserve.
Right.
But at least I could pay, you know, at least approach that.
Does this new album touch upon all your overcoming of adversity in your life and everything that you've been through? Does it reflect that experience in the music?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, not lyrically,
mm-hmm.
but what I would say is that the music expresses, you know, very, in a very big way, the depth of my commitment to the spiritual practice of kirtan and mantra singing, mm-hmm. which for the last, well, I'm 65, and I started doing this when I was about 15. And so the title, Roots Ark Rama, on one hand, it's a play on words, because a lot of the album, particularly CD1, is reggae inspired. And, you know, one of my great favorite songs is Roots Rock Reggae by Bob Marley. So I just liked kind of playing with that.
Uh-huh.
But the deeper explanation is that this practice is the root of my being, and it's what daily helps me overcome adversity. And rock meaning that it's my foundation. The mantra is my foundation. And Rama being the mantra. And, you know, the expression of in God, in a word, the expression of God.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically saying that this practice of chanting and singing mantras, and, you know, when I say chanting, sometimes people think of like a monotone chant, but no, it's very melodic and very, very rhythmic and colorful, you know, but that this, all these years of chanting these sacred mantras have made them the rock and the foundation and the root of every day of my life. And my main mantra that I sing is, it's not the only one, but is Rama. And so it's really, you know, but, you know, it's also a fun sounding phrase, Roots Rock Rama. I love alliteration, you know,
yeah.
And it's a real tip of the hat to reggae.
Yeah.
but on a deeper level, and I kind of write about it in the liner notes, it is, that's what it's about. It's about this practice that has saved and continues on a daily basis to save me, to help me face the challenges and, you know, each day re-overcome the adversities that come with life.
So when it comes to overcoming adversity, I understand that, you know, for you, and it is true, I think, for everyone, that overcoming adversity is a daily process. So when we say fall down 7 times, rise up 8, does that ring true for you? And what does it mean to you?
It totally rings true to me. The way I usually verbalize it in my own life and in my own mind is 2 steps forward, 1 step backwards. Mm. That the our evolution, you know, our growth, our personal growth, our just the journey of our lives, you know, it's always got ups and downs and stops and starts and difficulties. I think inherent in incarnation, you know, our birth, our life as a human being, inherent is suffering and struggles.
Right.
You know, look at Buddhist teachers. But the first tenet of Buddhism is that life is suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, so we stumble every day. I stumble, but I know that the light and the grace is inside me and is supporting me.
Mm-hmm.
That even though I stumble, I get up and take 2 steps forward.
Yeah.
And we also need to have we need to have compassion for ourselves, and you know, this is hard for me, but it's so true. We have to learn to not beat ourselves up for those 7 falls waiting, mm-hmm, for the 8th rise up, you know.
Yeah.
And we have to have patience with ourselves and with life in general, and a certain kind of faith, you know. Like when I say faith, I don't necessarily mean like religious faith or even spiritual faith, but we have to have a certain faith that our inner guru is guiding us toward the good, toward our highest expressions of our own selves. And, you know, it's hard to always keep that faith, but like just to have a trust that, yeah, I messed up this one. It's going to be okay. I'm trying. My heart intention is to walk in the light. So I know that the light will shine for me.
Beautiful. Beautiful, man. So where can people get the album and when?
Okay. Well, I'll start with when. It's going to be released on March 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
And where is pretty much everywhere. If there's a record store, CD store in your city, anyone who's listening. I don't know if there are CD stores. There are some.
Are there any left? Yeah.
There's a few. And it will be available in all those CD stores. And, of course, it's available it will be available to order Amazon.com and all the sites that sell music, and my own website, which is just jaiutal.com, JAIUTTAL. You can order through there. And, you know, so it'll be pretty much available everywhere. There's one thing I really need to share that mm-hmm. I forgot is that I've partnered with a company called OneTreePlanted.org. And for every CD that is sold, every hard copy CD that's sold, a tree will be planted. So, you know, I think that's really another, I'm so happy that I'm so proud of myself and happy that avenue opened up, because it's, you know, one other way that this project can go towards helping the world. Yeah. But the album is now available for pre-order at jaiutal.merchnow.com. And merchnow is MERCHNOW. NOW. And with the pre-order, you get a signed copy of the CD signed by me, and we have so many cool things to offer, like T-shirts with the artwork on it, and shoulder bags with the artwork on it, hand-printed shawls from India, and you know, like we made a whole collection of beautiful, elegant, cool merchandise that is available for people to pre-order with the CD. Now, you can just pre-order the CD without the merchandise, and you can just pick and choose from the bundle. So, it's all the options are there. But yeah, I'm hoping that a lot of people will pre-order, and then I'll just have to spend a couple of days signing the CDs, and I'm happy to do that. just me and a Sharpie.
Great. So thanks so much for joining us. I think this was really great. We've been speaking with Jai Utall on Rise Up Radio. Thanks so much for joining us, Jai.
Thank you, Michael.
And again, the album is called Roots Rock Rama, and it will be available March 3rd, right?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. Keep me posted, okay?
Will do. Thank you.
And thanks to all the listeners.
If you know someone who has an inspiring story that we should interview, please email us at info@riseup8.org. I'm Michael Nova, and thanks for joining us on Rise Up Radio.